Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 352nd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormick, and I am a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta. And James, now you said the 352nd, so this will be 350 times or 350% better than the previous ones?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, this will be the best one.
Okay. And because we're talking about numbers here, and there'll be a certain plus or minus around that guarantee of how much better this will be.
Oh, yeah. And we can get into that at the end.
Okay.
So if people are wondering where we're going with this introduction, I actually don't know, but I will put us back into track.
So neither did I.
No, exactly. So if you've listened to the previous one episodes, you know that we're going to be talking about some stuff to do. We're going to do a deep dive into lab tests, and we're probably going to do probably two or three podcasts on some of the concepts around lab tests and lab measurements. Because one, I did a talk for a lab group in Seattle about a month or so ago, and it was a really interesting process of trying to come up with information that would be of value to them and sort of delve into the nuances of lab reporting. And the title of the presentation that I made was sort of lab reporting, the cause of and the cure of, I've got to get exactly the right title if I'm going
to
do it right.
The cause of and solution to.
Yeah, the overdiagnosis problem. And that comes from a Simpsons line to do with alcohol. Mm-hmm. And there are some nuances that I think healthcare providers need to be very familiar with when it comes to looking at lab values. Because, and I think, Mike, you'd agree, I mean, the vast majority of diagnoses that we make are either completely lab dependent, or at least very or partially lab based dependent.
Yeah, and you've written down a few here. Would you like to go through just maybe six columns?
Yeah, the six guys put up a slide of, and it's literally probably hundreds of things. And I'm sure many of you can think of all of the things that we do from a lab test, and even just the simplest ones of, you know, cholesterol. And I realize that blood pressure is not a lab test, but we use measurements to make decisions around a lot of things. And actually there's been an estimate that, and you got to be very careful when the statement starts off, it is commonly thought, because you know, if that's, if someone says that, you know, the next few lines are going to be a bunch of BS. But
in keeping with the rest of the podcast series.
Exactly. and so some people have suggested that lab tests provide 2/3 to 3/4 of the information used for making medical decisions. I have no idea if it's 2/3 to 3/4, but I think...
Or a quarter.
It is a lot. And I think we can agree on that, whatever a lot is.
Now, I would disagree with some of the things you have, like proteinuria. For me, I ask patients about foam in the toilet bowl after they pee, and then if they can't recall, I have them pee at the office and then go in and look at the foam in the toilet, because I think I try and bring it back to clinical context all the time.
But you know, that again is a measurement, my friend.
You're right about that. It's a visual inspection.
So you know, we've talked a lot about on the podcast about the issues of, you know, overdiagnosis, and there's no doubt there's underdiagnosis, but I think there's also an issue of overdiagnosis, and there's so many factors that are involved in it. You know, it's actually all of us are involved with it, and it's not, you know, with this session that we're going to be doing, we're not going to say that it's all the fault of the lab, but they are a major player in it, but so are clinical practice guidelines, and also patients and the media and all that sort of stuff. So I think I totally understand that this is not necessarily the complete solution to the overdiagnosis problem, but it's useful to be able to know some of the nuances of lab tests.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what we're going to do is sort of work our way through the thought process. And a lot of this came for a variety of reasons, is that, as you know, Mike, their lab tests are now being made available to patients. And that's not new, but it is fairly new.
Right. And that comes with challenges in people. Many of those things, though, that come with patients. So, example, my hemoglobin was 121 and now it's 119, and it's mm-hmm. it's indicating that it's low now, but it wasn't last year when I tested it. So mm-hmm. You know, as an example, and we even as clinicians, you know, heed that once you've crossed that magic threshold. But and we all put more credence than I think is appropriate on changes in lab values that are sometimes not much more than variance. And I think you're going to spend a lot of time talking on that.
Yeah, and hopefully not in the boring variance way, but give it practical nature. Because I, you know, in the States recently, probably about 3 years ago, that there was a new rule that says, you know, they need to grant patients direct access to lab results. And so we do that in Canada. It's always being done in the States. But, you know, if you could think of, again, what would be the worst thing that one could possibly do would be to send out the exact same report that goes to healthcare providers. Because, you know, healthcare providers can barely understand lab reports and the nuances associated with it, yet we somehow think that patients can deal with all those things. And it does get very, very tricky, because I've talked to a number of people who get these reports, and, you know, they even far less than any clinicians don't understand the nuances of exactly what we're going to be talking about. So it is very, very tricky to know what, you know, how to deal with that. And so, you know, I what we want to do is we talk about this. And I think I sort of want to start off with the premise, or my thesis, if you will, is that, and this is a quote that I came up with, if you will.
Therefore, it's the better one. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And if you make a quote, then it's real. But, it, you know, basically from much in medicine, we knowingly sell preeminent precision when really we all know in our heart of hearts that we can only deliver educated imprecision. And I think most patients would be very understanding about that if we were just more open about it. And what I want to do is work our way through the imprecision of lab tests and how to help people think about it. Because, you know, you and I joke a lot about these sorts of things, but you know, we do know that we sell this preeminent precision. Wouldn't you agree?
And I think there's a, if you pull down that curtain or veil, mm-hmm. you're going to reveal the appearance of a lack of science or magic. That notice the two together.
Yes.
That we kind of rely on, and I think people, you know, many patients believe that we provide yes or no answers with tests.
Yeah, exactly.
And they provide nothing of the sort.
Yes.
They provide probabilities and help us move towards higher probabilities or certainties, yeah. But we never get certain.
Yeah, you know, there's a few examples where it's black and, you know, almost, but very few of those. And so
death, that's the closest. That's the closest.
You heard it here first from a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well done.
Who may have made that diagnosis in himself.
Yeah, and hopefully has rarely caused it. But given it, these things are always tricky. So anyway, so whenever you get a lab result, you know, we always think about things like, well, is it an error? Are there, you know, is it a lab error? And often people will repeat it just to go, well, I wonder if it's real or was it a lab error? And, you know, I think, you know, decades ago, there were a lot more lab errors than there are today. And there's a report recently, not recently, within the last about 10 years ago, where there was an actual look at to see if there are lab errors. And by that, you know, where, you know, the sample was contaminated or it's got the wrong name on it or it wasn't refrigerated properly or the machine blew up when it was doing the test, you know, mm-hmm. all of those sort of those actual lab errors. And when you try to quantify those, they are about 0.3% of lab results. So that's, I think that's actually quite good. And I think people would actually be surprised at that low number. And it is much lower than it was decades ago.
Yeah, certainly the ones that matter, right?
Like, yes.
So and I can think of really obvious cases where it was lab error. And when you think about the amount of practice that I've had and all of that kind of thing, it's not that common.
Mm-hmm.
The one that sticks out in my mind the most is an A1C that came back as, and this person had normal screening in the past, mm-hmm. and their A1C came back as 10 or 12 or something very high, north of 10. And it just didn't seem reasonable. I couldn't repeat it because the powers that be will not let you repeat A1Cs that quickly. So we did a couple other tests for sugars, and they were normal. We waited. We repeated the A1C, and I think it was a two-month interval or something, and it was normal. And so in that case, that was clearly a lab error.
Yeah, it had to, because there was no way it could be that high.
That can't be a variance in person, yeah. Exactly. And so, but they're, you know, I see those maybe once a year kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so if you're thinking about how many tests we order, this 0.3 means one in every 300 or so. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's actually, you know, we would come across, because of some patients are getting a lot of, like if you have any renal patients and they're seeing nephrology, they're getting almost that number of tests
every month.
Exactly. So things can happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not that when we see variants of people moving, or, and I know apparently the word variance is boring.
No,
it's cruel what you said. I think my therapist will back me up on that. But when we're seeing those things that I referred to earlier, like, you know, hemoglobin moving from 121 to 119, that isn't lab error.
No, exactly. And one of the things we need to spend time about is defining the terms that we're using so that people can appreciate, because, you know, when you say, you know, the changes are not real, people sometimes think that's a lab error, and it's not that at all. It's not the fault of someone. So let's sort of work our way through that. And just in case you're wondering, this is not, I think 0.3% is very good, because, you know, when you look at the chance of in pharmacy of dispensing errors, we're probably upwards of around 1% to 2% where we have the, you know, wrong drug, wrong person, those sorts of numbers. So, you know, this is absolutely kudos to the lab, who've done a superb job of not completely eliminating lab errors, but at least getting it down to a number where it you know, that's not the issue we're actually going to be talking about.
Yeah, and all of us have had those where it's can fax back from the pharmacy, or when you're in hospital, it gets the nurses catch it or whatever. My favorite was mistaking diltiazem and digoxin. So the nurse politely asked me about his digoxin. She said, "Now, with his digoxin, did you want me to bring that in two pails or a wheelbarrow?"
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, it never caused any problems, but many years ago when I was a practicing pharmacist in the dispensary, I dispensed the wrong birth control pills, and it was brought back to my attention. "These are different colors than they were before. Are you sure it's right?" And I went, "Oh, shoot, no, I'm wrong."
So mine was if not my very first case in medical school, where I was the one actually writing things in the chart and all that. But if not the very first, it was within the first month. And so, yeah.
So these things happen. Yeah. That's not what we're talking about. So we talked about the fact that we're trying to sell this precision. And I think there's a couple of issues associated that we create ourselves by sort of, if you will, faking this precision. Because I think it sets up a few beliefs, and you can expand on these if you want. But the first belief is that when the numbers change when you get a different number the next time, that those changes are real. And we'll talk a lot about that. And the other belief is that these thresholds are relatively black and white. You've already talked a little bit about that. And that is just not true. And those beliefs can lead to all sorts of feelings of either fear and happiness or frustration or confusion. And it's all actually based on almost nothing, because the numbers are often haven't changed and so on. And we see that the frustrations in both patients and clinicians. And I'm sure you'd probably agree with that.
Oh, one of the classic for this, and I think some of the frustration that comes with monitoring your sugars at home, is the reality that they fluctuate so much. And I remember, I think the first case report I ever wrote up was a fellow who had overdosed on insulin, and I was shocked to learn that the timing of when you measure someone's sugar levels to when they actually have symptomatic effects from low sugars they're not perfectly in sync. So someone can have a sugar level of you know, 2 or 1.5 and still not be symptomatic. That is coming.
Yeah, exactly.
Very,
yeah.
Very soon. But they might not be just yet. And exactly. So I was fascinated to learn about these kind of discrepancies. And then at home, your patients will say, you know, I was eating perfectly, and I had a sugar of 10. And then when I went for and then I was eating terribly, and my sugar was 6.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. how does this make any sense? And they're right that it doesn't always make sense.
Yeah. And some of that has to do with a variety of different things. Some of it is measurement issues, but some of it is just the natural fluctuation, which is actually part of the measurement issues that we're going to get into.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's sort of set a landscape, if you will, because there are, and let's assume, like we've said before, let's assume there's no pre-analytical problem. So the timing, which is kind of what you just mentioned a little bit, but there's no labeling issue. So we've got actual measurements that are legitimate for that patient. So that's the framework that we're talking about. So there's some measurement landscapes that there are terms for this. There are population-based reference intervals, and we'll spend a little bit of time talking about those. Then there's the analytical variation, and there is biologic variation. And then there's a thing that I bet many clinicians have never heard of, but I had not heard of it at this when we put this together, was a thing called reference change values, or RCVs. And what we're going to do is sort of work our way through what all those mean, hopefully in a way that makes some sort of sense. And I promise you, as our listeners, we will come to some bottom line answers and some guidance and some suggestions. So we're going to take all the clothes off of the emperor, and then we're going to put him back in a Speedo at least. How about that?
A wonderful image. Mm-hmm. For assuming that you're the emperor.
Exactly. So, and I think you probably agree with this, Mike, as well, that when we are doing a test of something, whether it be a lab test or a measurement of something, we want to know what the results are now and have they changed. And so how do we figure all that out? And I thought one of the best sort of analogies to think about it is, and you can tell me if you don't like this analogy, and I'll continue on with it anyway. But one of the best ways I've used when I'm talking to students about this is, if you were to try to measure someone either with a 1 foot ruler or even a tape measure, every time you measure, if you're measuring their height, every time you measure their height, you can get and probably will get a different answer for reasons that maybe you weren't able to accurately put the 1 foot ruler on top of itself each time when you're doing it. You maybe couldn't get to the very top of the person's head, or you couldn't see at the top of the head, or maybe the tape measure was twisted. Those are the analytic errors, the actual testing unit that's associated with figuring out that measurement. So that's the way of thinking about analytic variability. And I can't really come up with better. Do you have any other better examples? But that's kind of the way. It's the test that even though the tape measure is a very good tape measure, how it's being used by the operator. Maybe it's got kinks in it that you didn't know, and those sorts of things. Those are the analytic variability, and we're going to talk about those first, and then we're going to get to the biologic variability.
No, I think that's relatively that's a very good analogy. I just wish there was someone else to describe it.
I know. Well, I did a god awful job of it, but we'll go forward from there. So that's the analytic variability. Now let's assume the biologic variability comes into the person's whose height we are measuring. So you can envision, let's say you're trying to measure someone's height, they may or may not be wearing shoes or socks, or they may not, or they may be slouching. Or if you measured the height of a child over the next 2 to 2 months, they may gain height.
Right.
They
could have a compression fracture if they're older.
Exactly.
Or they could have traveled in space and come back with more bulgy discs or more firm discs, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So that's all the biologic variability that's associated with basically every test. But, you know, if you were to do repeat measurements of a person who's standing in front of you of their height, and every time the test comes back that their height has changed, in your head, you are fully capable of saying, yes, I know the numbers changed, but I know their height has not changed. That is easy to do because we know heights don't change, you know, second to second unless you really slouch and, you know, take off your shoes or your skates or whatever it was that you were wearing. So we can, as humans, understand that. But where we struggle with is when we get the lab result back, where we are, I think, less, maybe I'm not giving many people the benefit of the doubt. I think it's more difficult for us to then step back and do that. So we're going to talk about the analytic variability. We're going to talk about the biologic variability. But before we get to all of those, we want to talk about the population-based reference intervals, because I'm not sure if everyone even understands that. And that's, where do we get this, the range for when you get a lab test back to know whether it's lower or higher than normal? And I think we need to talk about that. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So when most, and this is not, we're talking in generalities here, most population-based reference intervals, the ones that you see on labs, are, arbitrary is not completely true, but we have arbitrarily chosen that we are going to use the interval where 95% of healthy people fall. So in other words, the way that these population-based reference intervals are determined is we are going to take a bunch of people who do not, at least as far as we know, have medical conditions. We're going to measure in hundreds and or thousands of people their potassium and sodium and so on and so forth. We are then going to get, when you do that, for almost every measurement in humans, you get a bell-shaped curve, for the different measurements. And then we are arbitrarily going to say that the lowest 2.5% and the highest 2.5% of healthy people, we are going to say that is outside the range. And so I'm not sure if everybody realizes that population-based reference intervals are very rarely have anything to do with unhealthy people.
No, they're not included. It's kind of like a group of people without causes for being taller or shorter being measured, and then the tallest 2.5% being called, basically there's something wrong with them.
Right.
And the shorter, no one speaking now is included in this, being considered unhealthy because of their height. So it's a fascinating thing. We draw these when these studies are done, these reference values are established, there's a recognition that healthy people are on the outside of this range, and there's nothing wrong with them, but their values for that specific lab test are slightly high or slightly low.
Right. But, and we're not trying to discount the fact that, when you see a potassium of 8, it's something to think about. Or a potassium of 1. You know what I'm saying? So there's no doubt that those people are likely got something going on.
I would say a potassium of 8 and 1. The first thing is, as the clinician, the need for an urgent new pair of underwear.
Exactly. And I'm purposely going to the very extreme on these to put it into context. So let's work with that. So we have this, what we call the population-based reference intervals. So now we're going to get into statistics. Are you ready, Mike?
Oh, I'm excited about it. Yeah. I hope you're going to talk about the Mann-Whitney U test, because that's the one that's,
I mean, it's edge of your seat stuff. So let's assume, and we've talked about this on previous podcasts, but we need to put it into the context of this one, is that let's assume you have a person who is normal in front of you, that is healthy, otherwise healthy. The more tests you do, obviously, if you're looking at that 5% of test results will be outside that reference range, the more tests you do, the greater chance you have of having one abnormal test. So I don't think it's difficult to figure out the math on this, but if by definition we've decided that population-based reference interval is the 5%, if it's outside 5%, we think it's abnormal. If you do a single test, 5% of them will come back being abnormal, for which people are not, they're otherwise healthy. So I think that's obvious, right?
Wait, no.
I know.
You might need to go over that again. So if you're saying if 5%, we set the established boundary at 95%, we're going to capture 95% of people and call them normal, that the other 5%
will
be called abnormal.
Yes,
you've heard it here first.
Yes, you heard it here first. Yeah. Just like from Dr. Allen, who said, people die. Now, what's interesting, though, is more interesting, is that the more tests you do, the greater chance you have of finding an abnormal one, for which it's only because it was outside that reference range. And so if you do two, it goes up to 10%. But when we get to things like numbers, it's not completely additive. So if you do 10 tests based on a statistical number, about 40% of the time, if you do 10 tests, one will be abnormal, not because it's actually abnormal. It's just outside that reference range. And then when you get up to 15 tests, it's like 50-50 that one is going to be abnormal. And that would not be an unusual, you know, if you do some screening stuff, it would be not unusual to do 10 tests.
To say the least. Yeah, often do my lab forms using a ruler so I can draw a straight line through all the tests.
So anyway, so if you do 10, it's 40%. If you do 15, it's about 50%. And if you do 20, it's about 60% chance of having an abnormal test for which it's not abnormal.
Right. Now you'll note that 20 isn't 100.
No.
20 times 5
is
100.
And so, you heard it here first.
James, this is not making sense. And so you're saying that numbers don't always make sense.
They don't matter.
They don't at all. like the number in my salary. My boss keeps telling me it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And so we're not going to spend much more time talking about population-based reference intervals. There's a whole debate about that, but that's the one key piece of information that you need to know about these population-based reference intervals. Now, the next thing is, so that's the problem with that. So what we want to do now is sort of talk about the issue of the actual lab result. Because every lab result gives you, and you probably know, you know this, Mike, and people who are listening, you get an exact number. I don't know if you've noticed that.
No, this is news to me. So yeah, keep
going.
Keep it coming. Yeah. So some have decimal places. So we're talking serious precision here.
Oh, absolutely. So lab results are reported as an exact number, sometimes to a ridiculous number of decimal points. And sometimes not, depending on how, you know, it could be 100 or it could be 1.00, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But everybody, and I think most people realize that every test result is really only a range that hopefully includes the true result. And, you know, that can be for tests can be as small as 1 or 2%, but for many tests and for many tests that you guys do on a regular basis, it is plus or minus 20 to 30%.
Yeah, or more.
It can even be more. I'm just trying to be as kind as I can about lab tests. And so when you have that sort of variability, and we're going to spend time talking about that and give you examples of where that is, you know, you need to know that, because it's that variability that allows you to figure out has there actually been a change? Because the population-based reference intervals that we just talked about are really of no use in evaluating serial results obtained from an individual, because a single test will tell you where we think the person is now. And we've just talked about the population-based reference intervals for that. The next step is to go, okay, often we want to know, has it changed? And we do serial results. And that's where the variation in the test, and you need to be very aware of what that is to put that into context. So I'm looking at the podcast clock, and we're at about 28 minutes or so, a little bit longer. I think we should just leave people in suspense.
I agree, James. It's riveting. So many of you will have gone to see movies or are familiar with certain TV shows that you find very captivating, and some of you are counting down to the Game of Thrones. This, I think, is far more captivating and fascinating. I'm sure they're on their edge of their seats at home. Counting and you're going to space these podcasts apart, which is really going to be devastating for many
cruel.
Of them.
Yeah, this will go down in the annals of podcast history, where they'll go. It's like, you know, the last show of MASH or who shot JR.
Yeah, just holding them on.
Yeah,
bated breath. Yeah,
about what's going to go on. So, just to sum up, we've spent a little bit of time talking about the potential problems of lab results, not again the fault of the lab, but just some issues. And we talked about the population-based reference intervals. And the next podcast, we're going to be delving into the variability of each individual lab test and then give you some tools and suggestions for how to deal with that as we go forward. How does that sound?
Yeah, awesome, James. Excited about it.
I know. Edmonton course?
Edmonton course in October. We're going to soon be releasing...
The hounds.
Sending out course material for people to start registration probably in kind of late August, early September. And we know many of you are chomping at the bit. And as you know, this year we have the video broadcast of the conference, which I think that
it's you're live streaming it is what you're trying to say.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I said. What are you interrupting me for?
Oh, yeah, I'll go back and fix that in post production.
It's like a variance, right? Yeah, it's like the what's around the truth. So
that's your alternative fact.
We'll never let that go. For those of you who live quite a distance from Edmonton, can't attend that way, we would love to have you still tune in, and you can ask questions as the sessions go. So it's just like you're there, except you don't get to meet with James in person. Yeah. So that way may be why many of you choose.
Yeah. And then you don't get the snow and the mosquitoes.
Yeah. Well, it's October, so yeah. The mosquitoes will be lower. There's no promising on snow.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then our course in Vancouver is May 4th and 5th of 2018, and we're in the next month or two, we'll be starting to put together the program for that. So we'd love it if you could put that into your calendar and think about attending. So I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.